This is Across Divides, a series of stories and experiences from communities across the island of Ireland as they meet shared challenges and consider opportunities for collaboration. Find out more at icommunityhub.org. This is Across Divides, and I'm Alex McMaster. In this episode, we'll be looking at mental health across the island and ways in which civic society can respond to its various dimensions. I'm joined today by Morgan Shuttleworth, a final year student at Methody College Belfast and president of the Secondary Schools Union of Northern Ireland. Siobhan O'Neill is a professor at Ulster University and mental health champion for Northern Ireland. Her research programmes focus on trauma, mental illness and suicide behaviour in Northern Ireland. And finally joining us today is Peter McBride. Peter is a post-conflict mental health specialist. He's worked on the influence of trauma on the capacity of individuals, groups and communities to engage in peacemaking and reconciliation processes. Thank you to all of you for joining us for this episode. I'd like to start with you, Morgan. During the pandemic, you started a cross-border organisation. You're in your final year of school, and you started this with students, and it dealt with a lot of issues that were faced by students. And I'm wondering, mental health became a really sort of central topic of that organisation. I'm wondering why that came about and sort of how the organisation came about in the first place.
So the union was founded in August of 2020 during the whole sort of algorithm exams sort of situation that was going on, and out of a need for students to be heard and for their voices to be heard, all these decisions were being made for our future and we weren't being consulted. So the guy that set it up, Cormac Savage, he asked me to come on board as the mental health officer. Mm-hmm. So the work I did was the mental health report we launched. We launched a survey, and the report was based off that, and it was just about mental health provisions in school and what was and wasn't working for young people. So I think our aim wasn't so much to make mental health the forefront of the union, but I think last year, for whatever reason, it was one of the projects that was sort of our most recognised and sort of biggest that came across.
Mm-hmm. And was that the reason why it became so prominent? I guess, was that in some way rooted in the fact that the organisation came about during the COVID-19 pandemic? Mm-hmm. Or do you think it was a priority that grew during the pandemic at all?
I think sort of a mixture of both. It's always been a priority. I love to use the phrase, it was the endemic before the pandemic. You know, it's always been an issue here in Northern Ireland. So the need there is there for it very clearly. And I think the struggle has only grown to get more and better mental health provisions in Northern Ireland. So yeah,
absolutely. Thank you, Morgan. That's really interesting. I'll just come on to Siobhan actually briefly. Your role as Northern Ireland mental health champion is a relatively new one. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you why it is that the role came about, why it's important now, and why it is as well that you in particular were chosen. What aspects of your, I guess, background and expertise meant that your kind of work really fell into this role?
Okay, so again, thinking back to before the pandemic, so in early 2020, there was the New Decade, New Approach deal. And that was the deal that the ministers signed up to, all the political parties signed up to that. And it got them back into government after 3 years of a hiatus. Now, really, really important deal. And in there was a commitment to addressing mental health as an issue in Northern Ireland, because we were having that conversation and we were starting to recognise that there was a huge need here. Mm-hmm. So in the New Decade, New Approach deal, there was a commitment to a plan to address mental health. The plan came out in March, just when the pandemic was starting. And within that plan, there was a commitment to addressing mental health in schools, which is relevant, of course, to what Morgan's doing, and also to developing a mental health strategy. Now, I had been working on this and talking about it a lot for the last 10, 15 years, because I'd been researching mental health at Ulster University and conducting various studies around suicide and mental health and the troubles in mental health. And so the year before, I had been part of a project where we produced this report called From Poverty to Reality. Mm. And this was calling for a 10-year mental health strategy, really summarising all the policies and strategies that we had that hadn't been implemented and saying, right, we just need a 10-year one. So in the mental health plan, there was the commitment to a 10-year mental health strategy. And this idea of a mental health champion that various groups had been advocating for. So having somebody to push forward that strategy, but to promote mental health and wellbeing through all of the government departments. And I think that's really fundamental, because mental health is not about, it's not about health. You know, health is an important part to play, but there's so much that all of the departments that are in government need to be doing to prevent mental illness, which is a big part of what I'm about. So the plan was there, the mental health champion idea was in there, and then I got a phone call in June asking would I be involved, and would I do it on an interim basis because we needed the strategy developed. Mm-hmm. And there was always that threat that government would collapse, so we had to get the strategy out quickly, and it was a one department strategy. And again, you know, that's not ideal, but the programme for government needs to have mental health all the way through it, with all the parties committed to that. But this was one department making commitment to addressing these issues. So I came on board in August and had been working then on the strategy, helping with the strategy, writing drafts, working with groups on the ground to establish what should be in the strategy. And also before that, I'd been working with the Department for Education on what we needed to do in schools. Mm-hmm. So the framework was in that strategy, the emotional health and wellbeing framework for schools. So I was able to contribute to that as well. And then I got talking to justice and infrastructure and all and communities and all of those groups. So I then applied for it whenever, because public appointments take a while. So it was nearly a year before the thing came out and I applied for it and was lucky enough to get it. So now I'm here for three years, at least it could be extended, and working a day a week in the university, still bringing that research hat to this and thinking about the evidence base and everything that I do. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I'm really enjoying it too. Yeah.
And you mentioned that research base there that mm-hmm. you bring into it. And I guess that Peter will add to this, but and because his background is also very much in this area. But you mentioned there earlier that kind of intergenerational, transgenerational mm-hmm. trauma. And I wondered how much that kind of plays into your role now.
It's huge. Mm-hmm. So the first study I did on this issue was 2005, and we found at that stage really high rates of mental illness, trauma-related, conflict-related mental illness in that generation. They're now parents, and we know that childhood adversities, the relationship between parents and children, is fundamental to mental health and wellbeing. So their parenting has been affected, sadly, some of them, you know, and Our young people are now growing up in a world where there's other stressors, and the society that their parents have lived in and the society that they're living in is impacting on their mental health. And we still have the legacy of the troubles, sadly, impacting the lives of young people. So that's what transgenerational trauma really is. It's about trauma that one generation are exposed to that impacts in the lives of their offspring. Mm-hmm. And that affects them. And there's a biological element of this, and we could talk a wee bit about that too. Mm-hmm. You know, but the good thing is that by intervening early, you can prevent things from getting worse, you can help young people manage their well-being, and that's what I'm all about, trying to create that change and trying to raise awareness of the possibilities here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I guess you lead in really well there into the kind of work, as I said, that Peter mm-hmm. Peter has been doing, and Peter, your work focuses so much on that intergenerational trauma, but you've worked all around the world doing this kind of research. And I just wondered what you've kind of gained from that work that you've been able to then take back to the island, and that's been able to contribute to the work that then you've done here.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I worked in mental health services for about 30 years here in Northern Ireland. And it may sound strange to say this, but it wasn't until the latter part of my career that I started to make a connection between mental health services and people's experience of mental illness here and the troubles. Mm-hmm. And that may sound strange to an audience, but actually it was part of the challenge here. People did not necessarily make attribution between the high levels of mental illness. For example, all the research that Siobhan has done, which shows the high levels of mental illness in Northern Ireland and the high levels of suicide and things that we can track directly back to a consequence, part of the legacy of the Troubles. But maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, there was no attribution. We would not have made that connection. In working overseas, I just spent the last year in America, where I was involved with a Holocaust, interesting connection, Holocaust and Genocide organisation. And their attraction of me, to me, was the connection they were making that I've certainly made between experiences of genocide or atrocities and the impact that has on a population, and therefore the consequential then relationship between that and a population's ability to make peace. Mm-hmm. So what we have here in Northern Ireland is a 20-year-old now peace process, but a society that is still divided. We're still arguing about integrated education. We still have a divided healthcare system. We have many elements of our society where sectarianism is still really at the core. And the root causes of that, the trauma component to that, that feeds that isolation, that feeds that kind of othering process, is actually very difficult to talk about. So in terms of learning coming back, there's learning that has come out of Northern Ireland, internationally, South Africa. There are lots of places that look to Northern Ireland as an example of a fantastic peace process, and it was. But there's also a lot that we need to learn here and now about getting beneath what is apparent and getting at some of the root causes of the ongoing divisions and the ongoing tensions that there are in our society. So I think we have a lot to learn, actually, from other organisations, other countries, as well as having a lot to offer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you think, when we talk about mental health, we can talk about, I guess, at different levels, and you've kind of, and I mean in terms of looking at the individual or the group or the community or the society, and I suppose where your work has been different in that sense is that you have kind of brought it up to the group level.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk a bit more about the importance of that and why you've brought it in.
So as you move from the individual into groups, you move away from something that is that can be clinically defined in terms of, an individual's person's symptomology, into group behaviours. And I draw the parallel often. I mean, the three main symptom clusters associated with trauma are re-experiencing of the event, the sort of memory, compromising memory creation, avoidance, and hyperstimulation. You can take those three principles and think about how those apply when large groups start to behave like that. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the issue about memory, a typical reaction around trauma is that people will re-experience the event rather than process it into becoming a memory. And so 10, 15, 20 years on, when you're talking to someone who's experienced trauma, it is as if it happened yesterday. Mm-hmm. Now think about how that might apply in a large group setting, where in Northern Ireland we have a real struggle with how we remember things. Mm-hmm. We have a tendency to want to recreate them. So even in the way that we reenact atrocities of the past or things that have happened in the past, it's a reflection of trying to hold on to something, keep it alive, rather than to let it subside into memory. It's the same with the sort of avoidant behaviour. Large communities that just often don't want to engage in the difficult issues of separation that are around, or difficult issues around sectarianism, or the difficult issues about how they feel about, inverted commas, the other. And then the sort of hypervigilant situation that groups find themselves in, where they absolutely believe themselves to be under threat, where that sense of fear, anxiety, being under threat, being at risk, is palpable within that community's narrative and that life. The threat may or may not be there, but it is a felt experience of those communities. And those criteria, those three main themes, are a direct link up from those communities' experiences of trauma, and have a really profound effect on any initiatives that involve those communities reaching out, engaging with the inverted commas other, or starting to question maybe their own identity or question what has happened to them. So I think that, I mean, the work that Siobhan and others have done around helping us understand trauma, helping us understand transgenerational trauma, When you translate that up into communities, what you see is that Northern Ireland particularly is a very peculiar place. It has a, I don't mean that in a negative way, it has a very particular set of issues that are going on that are not always easily able to be discussed.
I just think that's so important. Once you start looking at things through that trauma-informed lens, totally changes everything. And it's part of my role is to give people that understanding of how our bodies and brains react to stress and how we react to trauma and what the things, the stupid things we do when we're in that fight or flight, when we get we get angry, we make poor decisions. And I think the pandemic, you know, a lot of us were there at the start of the pandemic. We were scared. Yeah. We didn't know what we should do. So we were looking for who to blame for this and where the blame lay. And then we were stockpiling toilet roll and things like that, you know. There might be a biological reason for that, a trauma response too. But it affects our behaviour. So we all have that. And even just to get out that understanding of I'm in fight or flight mode now. I actually need to get back down to what I call safe and social.
Yeah.
Rather than fight or flight. But that sort of basic trauma lens, you can apply it to so many things, but it really shifts how we do things. It shifts our policies whenever we're thinking about building peace. We don't just go in there and bring down a peace wall and just tell people you need to be mixing together, you know? And it changes how we deal with stuff in the classroom.
Yeah.
We look at kids' behaviour in a different way. We start to teach our children and young people about this. And we start to understand even social violence has come in from a place of very real fear.
Yeah.
And if you want to address that, you've got to look at the source of the fear.
Absolutely.
And you've got to build trust and you've got to build psychological safety. And you've got to equip people and empower people with an understanding of how their body and brain reacts to stress and trauma.
And the challenge of this, because this is absolutely spot on, and the challenge for that is that that is normal here. And people don't, I think one of the challenges when we start talking about the old island thing is that what is normal in Northern Ireland? People will not particularly question what Siobhan has just described. And young people even growing up into this, because it's what they've always experienced. Unless we have a way of being able almost to step out ourselves or look through the trauma lens and begin to say, well, if I look at the world, if I understand a bit about how trauma affects people and I look at some of these behaviours, maybe can I understand this differently? If we don't do that, then what we do is we look around and we go, well, this is normal, so let's just keep doing it. And I think that's one of the real challenges around Northern Ireland's relationship with the rest of the island, or in fact beyond that, understanding that there are peculiarities to this. But we think this is normal.
And other people from the Republic of Ireland looking up just see what looks like very bizarre behaviour. And strange symbols, flags, all of the stuff. But this is about our trauma. And they don't get it. And, you know, the social violence that many of us experienced and were exposed to as young people, it was a normal part of our life. You know, if things, you know, if you didn't like what was happening, you literally could go out in the street and riot. That's what people did. So it's a very weird thing. And then, of course, once the peace process happened, it was a very new reality and quite destabilising for people who needed those safety behaviours, who needed the security. And it needed to be part of a tribe. We all need to be part of a tribe. And one of the things I'm looking at is suicidal behaviour. And we've actually seen an increase in suicidal behaviour post-conflict.
That's right.
And one of the theories is that actually the conflict drew us into our groups and we felt safe there. We knew who we were, what we were about, what our purpose was. And people who would have otherwise maybe have been very marginalised and in situations where suicidal behaviour may be more common, we're actually part of something, you know, part of something bigger and had a sense of purpose. So whenever all that started to dissipate, we saw an increase in suicide and suicidal behaviour. And, you know, that's all part of the story of us in Northern Ireland. That's part of our history, part of our story.
The other thing, I think this is so, so incredibly important. The Northern Ireland peace process had produced a political system which was designed to stop violence. It wasn't designed to promote peace. And in many ways, the Good Friday Agreement was meant to be a temporary, you know, the structures of government, a forced coalition government, were intended to be a temporary time to move towards what could be described as more normal politics. We currently have a political situation which mirrors the divides in society, and that reinforces some of those old fears and anxieties that were relevant during the time of the conflict, and therefore trauma here gets reenacted again and again and again, and that again becomes normal. And so what young people absorb, and what I'm sure is part of the story behind the suicidal thing, is that anxiety, that fear, that sense of existential threat gets internalized. And people don't know how to make sense of it, because it's what we've always known.
And stable leadership is so important. Stable leadership is so important. I mean, this very idea that you could have a five-party mandatory coalition with two leaders. You know, I mean, that's splitting. That's always splitting. You know, the pack needs one leader, and the two leaders who are completely polar opposite, and it's a recipe for a disaster. And we've seen it, I think, with the pandemic as well. Where, you know, and then we feel scared because our leaders are scared. Yeah. You know, we need solid leaders. We need people who can self-regulate, who can radiate calm, and then everybody else gets calm. And I think that's the worry for young people, is that without that stable leadership, young people think, they look at other countries where there's a lot of stuff happening, a lot of progressive things are happening, and they just leave. We educate them and they leave.
I suppose that's such an interesting bit of sort of intergenerational trauma linking to the brain drain, because obviously we don't really haven't experienced the same sort of troubles mentality, if you will, that we're not completely separated from the intergenerational trauma, but a lot of young people take a step back and go, well, I'm not staying here, and that's what the brain drain is. They're looking at this through a more rational, almost, lens, similar to those probably in different countries. People are looking at us through that lens and going, well, why am I staying here? Why am I going to put myself through this system that is so flawed, needs so much change and help, that I could move, you know, to the Republic, to England, to other parts of the world, where there's less societal issues, almost.
Yeah, well, that's something. I mean, you both mentioned that this is this kind of issue. You've mentioned, you know, how things are repeating themselves, and I'm just thinking about how that cycle kind of ends. And you've both mentioned that. I mean, Peter said earlier on that this issue of a lot of current mental health issues being rooted in that intergenerational or transgenerational trauma is something that kind of came up halfway through your career.
Yes.
And so it's something that's you know, it's emerging. And I'm just wondering for you, Morgan, what difference that kind of, and also, I mean, you guys are still obviously working in this area, so how that kind of being equipped with that kind of knowledge, that this is something that exists, that this is something that affects the mental health of the current generation as well, how that kind of informs the actions that you can take now, and the recognition of these issues, you know, how you can use that knowledge as a tool now to tackle current mental health issues.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone would disagree that you can't overstate the effect that intergenerational trauma is having on mental health. It affects all areas. So when you're looking at young people, you're thinking, you know, what can we do? And all we can do really is provide the support, which isn't up to standard as it is. We need to get, you know, a decent standard of support and provisions in place for young people, and then more. You know, this is in our country, in Northern Ireland, we've got very used to having to do more and to sort of provide more to make our community sort of similar to that, to function at a normal societal level that could be compared to sort of the rest of the UK or the Republic. I'm sure you could talk about that a bit better.
No, that's really important. I'm wondering though, treatments for mental health problems, yes. I wonder though about overprotectiveness and overprotective parenting, and is that a legacy that has impacted the mental health of a generation of young people? And I think this was the situation in my upbringing, for example, where I was sheltered from the troubles, and a lot of, you know, I was given a lot of things. And we're now seeing really high rates of mental health problems in very privileged student populations, where they really don't have this ability to cope with stress. Whenever they encounter hardship, they can't deal with it. And one of the things that seems to be associated with it is overprotective parenting, overindulgent parenting, mm-hmm. where parents are really trying to do everything for their children and it's not working. So I think we really need to look at all aspects of it and go right back into what's happening in homes and that sort of dynamic between parents and their children and how children are equipped to deal with the ups and downs of life, you know, and how that post-conflict generation as parents, how they are as well.
And part of the motivation for that is fear. Mm. And people are, I think, you reflected back to me what I said, which is, you know, I operated for 20 years without making a connection. It's quite possible for people to behave a particular way and not quite know why. Mm-hmm. And when you're operating, one of the different ways of describing people who are frightened is people who are anxious mm-hmm. or depressed or scared. So we will sometimes pathologize things in our society that are actually about really fundamental. Society is like a container. Imagine society is a big bucket and it contains things. So in our society, we contain a lot of anger and a lot of fear and a lot of other emotions. And then we act them out. So you know, Siobhan talked about the, you know, when we're in that kind of fight or flight mode. Mm-hmm. But the problem is sometimes one of attribution. So how I might experience that might be, I just feel anxious. I don't know why I feel anxious. Mm-hmm. It's a generalized thing. Mm-hmm. And yet it can be the consequence of years and years and years and years of a whole different set of factors that I have no control over at all, that are to do with the environment in which I operate. And I just think it's incredibly important to find a way of talking about this mm-hmm. and making it feel relevant. Because I think what worries me, Morgan, about, you know, generations coming into this, will be quick to say, we didn't grow up in the Troubles, it doesn't really have anything to do with us. And I would argue that actually what you end up living with is a legacy that is very unconscious. It's hard to access. You might notice it when you leave, mm-hmm. you know, so when the brain drain happens and people go away, mm-hmm. suddenly they become conscious of this Northern Ireland identity and this Northern Ireland stuff that they weren't even aware of when they were living here. But so much of this is unconscious and so much of it is difficult to talk about mm-hmm. because we want to leave that stuff behind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, those were terrible times. Yet I think that we need to find a way of remembering this stuff constructively.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a cognitive load that we're all carrying. Yeah. And what we're doing, even with trying to repair the fractures through like shared education mm-hmm. and stuff mm-hmm. like that, we're forcing people together. But there's always that yeah. unconscious thing mm-hmm. in the background that yeah. we're carrying. I think you explained really, really well there just the whole idea of mental illness. We've changed in our thinking about mental illness mm-hmm. as well. You know, we really now understand mental illness to be a change in feelings and behaviours that yeah. result from what has happened to us
yeah. Yeah.
and the environment. You know, there's all these different diagnostic categories or whatever, but ultimately that's what it is. It's yeah. a shift in feelings and behaviour yeah. and some of us need a lot more help to get away from that shift, to rebalance again, and that's all mental health and mental mm-hmm. illness is really.
And that's so interesting because one of the sort of main myths of intergenerational trauma is that, you know, it's a very extreme, it's only very extreme yeah. cases. So say, you know, someone's parents were involved in an event that yeah. happened, or were in the army, or were in an organisation, that their children are more likely mm-hmm. to feel suicidal tendencies. Yeah. Whereas it's not that, it's such a more general, broad sort of effects to people rather yeah. than those really, really extreme cases.
Yeah. So part of the challenge we face here is exactly linked to this, Morgan. I remember talking to some friends when I was trying to think of a conceptual framework to understand how people have experienced this in Northern Ireland. So there are different categories of people. There are people who in Northern Ireland who are very clearly victims of yeah. the Troubles. Yeah. So there's a very clear line of attribution. And often it's very visible. These people are in wheelchairs or have, you know, physical illnesses. Mm-hmm. There are then a group of people who have mental illness as a direct consequence of the Troubles. And sometimes attribution is there, sometimes it's not. But there's often, if you poke around a bit, there's clearly a link. Mm-hmm. Then there's the rest of us. And when we talk about the rest of us, so if I talk about myself, I'll tell you a typical kind of conversation I would have had, which would be, I grew up in the Troubles, but they didn't really affect me. Mm-hmm. I didn't lose anybody. I didn't witness a bomb. I didn't. So I will tell you all the things that didn't happen to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then I'll tell you the things that did. I used to come home from school. My dad worked in Belfast. I would stand anxiously at the window. Honestly, I would do this, stand for about an hour and a half waiting for him to come home, mm-hmm. because I would have just seen on the TV that there had been bombs in Belfast. Mm-hmm. That's not normal for a child to do. Mm-hmm. It would be normal driving around in a car to be stopped by the army and have a rifle mm-hmm. pointed into the car. And people would be quick to say, it didn't really affect me. Mm-hmm. Almost because there's a hierarchy. When you're in a critical situation like that, or when atrocities are happening, and you're managing to survive it, mm-hmm. you tend to quickly think that the people who had it really tough were these ones. Inevitably, that is absolutely true. But it doesn't mean that it didn't affect the rest of us. Mm-hmm. So this question of attribution, how we find a way of describing this that doesn't pathologize it, mm-hmm. doesn't mean that we're all walking around with PTSD. A lot of people are, yeah. but not all of us. But there's a section of our population who, my age and my kind of generation, who are affected by this in ways that are very difficult to talk mm-hmm. about and find words for.
I was maybe a wee bit younger watching it on the TV, mm-hmm. the body count, how many, yeah. and how many were Catholic and how yeah. many were Protestants, like this mm-hmm. mattered, you know?
Yeah.
That was part yeah. of my reality. Like, if there was just numbers,
yeah.
and it was always very us and them. And I would have always said, no, it didn't affect me. I was out in the country. Mm-hmm. And then I started to realise it affected every
Absolutely.
Aspect of my life.
Absolutely.
My mother was there on the day of the bloody bomb, you know.
Yeah.
And it changed everything yeah. about how we were as a family, about my political views, about what school I went to, about how I was parented.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it just seeps through everything. Mm-hmm. And yet we were trying to... And I really was not exposed
yeah.
to it.
Yeah.
And in a way, I really wasn't. And... I've done okay, mm-hmm. but you know, it's so hard. It's permeated everything, and the temptation for me was also to leave.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
would I stay or would I go away? Mm-hmm. You know, and I still mm-hmm. grapple with that, and I don't know what I would tell my own daughter mm-hmm. about yeah. whether she should stay or go, because this stuff is still alive.
That's what the conversation you yeah. were having before the recording is: how yeah. do you define a victim? Yes, there's yeah. those clearly impacted yeah. sort of yeah. loss of limbs and yeah. wheelchairs, etc. But there is people that were there, say your next door neighbour,
yeah. Yeah.
It happened to, or you just happened to be down the street from a bomb, that still impacts you. And it's the
yeah,
same,
right,
you know,
yeah.
being searched by the army at a checkpoint, that sort of thing
yeah.
has become regular occurrence,
yeah.
you know, for your mm-hmm. generation, not for mine. Like, but that's still, so you saying that the Troubles didn't impact you when actually, you
yeah.
know, it did, nothing overly eventful,
yeah.
there wasn't one single incident that happened that you can name, but it's still sort of that mentality.
But it also changes how you see the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's that kind of worldview shift, which you think of as, I can't keep coming back to this, unless you hear differently,
mm-hmm.
you think it's normal.
Yeah.
And you
mm-hmm.
think that everybody thinks that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of the challenges. So, you know, one of the things about this podcast is we're thinking about an all-island approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it becomes interesting when, you know, Northern Ireland starts to relate then, or people in Northern Ireland start to relate to people from the Republic of Ireland and beyond, this question of identity,
mm-hmm.
language, things that are hugely important in Northern Ireland that the rest of the world looks on with a sense of bemusement
mm-hmm.
and weirdness, you know, what on earth are they getting so excited about?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
so there is something about how we understand ourselves and how we are able to describe that and engage with other people. So A, so that we can have relationship, you know, that
mm-hmm.
we can have a meaningful dialogue, but also B, so that we can understand ourselves differently as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess you've talked quite a bit about this kind of environmental, I guess this environment that the people are in and this kind of, I'm going to say sort of group level or high level or unconsciousness that's kind of affecting present day mental health. And then you've also talked about a kind of, what I'm seeing is a different kind of way of regarding mental health, which is the kind of pathological
yeah.
sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how the actual strategies to deal with mental health issues and the ways that we're currently dealing with them, both in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, how those actually address those unconscious strategies? Because the sense that I have is that it's taking a very individual approach. I may be wrong there, but I'm wondering how much those sort of means of dealing with mental health issues actually match these overlying problems that you've been talking about.
Well, it's starting to change, mm-hmm. you know, and I've got a project at the minute that's funded through Peace money, mm-hmm. Peace for money, and it's called Our Generation. And I was making the argument to get the money for the project that actually what you need to do is work at an individual level on self-awareness, emotional regulation, all of those skills around our stress response and how we adjust. And then it's through doing that that you will build a generation of people who will be able to have empathy, who will be able to find the solutions to our very complex problems. So you don't start by imposing solutions or putting people together. Mm-hmm. You start by developing critical thinkers who are self-aware, who can manage their own well-being, who can problem solve. Mm-hmm. And then that's how you get to the next stage. Mm-hmm. I think the problem is that a lot of our policies have been, and arguably, you know, the funding pot that this came from was all about just bringing people together. It was just, if people get to know each other, they realise that we're all human. You know, we're only two dimensions of Christianity. That's what we're talking about, this great divide that we have, you know. But actually, that stuff really doesn't work. We have to yep. start with the individual. And now I'm parachuting up another bit and really trying to promote family and community
yeah.
and psychological safety and family and community as a way of developing that critical awareness in people. And then we send them out to build peace, to connect, to break down the barriers, to live together. So I worry about, you know, even the shared education, integrated education argument, people need to want it. We need to see that it's a good thing yeah. and want it. And it needs to happen naturally and evolve. When we realise that we're all humans, when we can connect in that way, and we're not there yet. It's going to take another generation, but we're losing young people all the time. Yeah. We're losing the people who would be best able to do this because we don't have university places yeah. for them, we don't have jobs for them, and we're not building a progressive society that takes cognizance exactly. of their needs, of the issues that are Absolutely. Relevant to them, which is about their jobs and their futures yeah. and their sexual orientation, all this stuff. Like,
those are yeah. really key components to yeah. an attractive society. I mean, it's a bit trite, but I used to say people are more than capable of dealing with the past if they're excited and invested in the future, you know. So if there's hope, if there's a sense of a really tangible sense of progress, then people are motivated to deal with whatever has happened in the past. But if you think of mental health, people interchange the words mental health and mental illness in a really unhelpful way. I noticed you made a very clear distinction earlier on between the two. I always do as well. But think of it as a continuum where at the most extreme end, you have people who are really chronically mentally ill. And at the other end, you have perfect mental health, well, flourishing. OK, mm-hmm. In a situation where resources are tight, there's this inevitable thing to push it towards the critical care that's required for mm-hmm. people who are really mentally ill. The problem with that is it doesn't diminish the number of people who become mentally ill. It won't stop people getting mentally ill. The only way that will happen is investment in promoting mental health. Mm-hmm. And if you think about, tack that then on top of our government system. So this issue here about mental illness is a Department of Health issue. Mm-hmm. Wellbeing and flourishing goes across all government departments. It's about the whole of society. It's about education. It's about our young people and the things that you've described, Siobhan. So the challenge with this is, and we need to certainly make sure that people who are mentally ill are getting the very best services that are available to them. And I would argue with our legacy, there is an absolute requirement on us as a society to honour the cost of the troubles through providing, you know, state-of-the-art mental health services for people who are mentally ill, as well as then taking cognizance of this bigger issue around mental health and well-being in the rest of society. Mm-hmm. Because if we invest in that, then the burden of illness goes down. Mm-hmm. That's the only way to actually reduce the number of people who end up getting mentally ill is to stop it upstream. Mm-hmm. But that is not particularly politically attractive.
Well,
I was going to say your appointment is a beacon of hope.
Mm-hmm. And to say there's people who don't know the difference between stress and mental illness.
Yeah.
So we
yeah.
need to have that conversation. We need to treat the mental illness where it's there, but we need to start putting our money yeah. into prevention, because the suffering, the point point at which people receive help, the suffering and the damage that has been done
absolutely.
To themselves and everybody around them, you know, by treating PTSD 20 years after it started.
Ridiculous.
It's really bad. And this is, you know, I challenge political parties and politicians in this all the time. Mm-hmm. They see mental illness as something that needs to be treated. We need to provide counselling for our staff now. We need to be doing this. And they fail to recognise all of the other things that they could be doing in their role to prevent this stuff from happening. Mm-hmm. And it's costing us $3.4 billion every single year. That figure came out last week. Mm-hmm. And we spend $150 million on our mental health service. So, you know, this strategy is so good because it actually includes early intervention. Mm-hmm. It includes a plan that's going to have to be cross-departmental. And it got through and it got signed off. So that's a really good one from my perspective.
Very relevant, even sort of at a community level and a school level. All the schools that I know anyway that are the best at dealing with student mental health and student mental illness are the ones where there's been a suicide of a student in the past 5 or 10 years. So it is a reactive rather than proactive stance, and that's sort of shown up and down society.
Yes, is that something where, you know, you've mentioned that at the community level that kind of response can come from? Is this a kind of a policy gap, I guess, when you're talking about mental health and these kind of, I guess, starting off at the base before sort of, you know this kind of the opposite of, I guess, a reactive policy. Is this a gap that can kind of be filled in by community organisations, or that's being filled by civil society, communities, NGOs?
I think that civil society has an incredibly important role to play, because it takes it. It doesn't take it out of the particular issue of clinical, you know, disease within that sort of illness model. But if it is on top of that, then what it does is it brings it out into much broader issues in society. Mm-hmm. So the kind of services that one might think of as supportive around mental health, in promoting mental health, won't necessarily be called mental health services. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go to see a psychiatrist because you're mentally ill, it's called a mental illness. You have a diagnosis and there's a set of mental illness services. Once you get into a flourishing society and well-being, there are lots and lots of components that aren't called mental health interventions, but which all add together to promote mental health and well-being. And this is where civil society has such an important role, because cohesion, the kind of connections that civic society fosters in the rest of society, is part of what breaks down loneliness and part of what helps people seek help and support in ways that are not traditional. Not necessarily medical help and support, but just the kind of things that are going to help and promote their mental health and well-being. Mm-hmm. I also think that in our political environment, civic society has the freedom to say things that our politicians do not. Yeah. Our politicians are constrained by a system that is based on division, if I'm honest. Most of our politicians get elected because they identify with one side or the other. Civic society has the opportunity to challenge that and to speak across the divide and to speak for people on the ground who are living with this and experiencing it, irrespective of their religion or their political views. Mm-hmm. And I think that people have said to me in the past, Northern Ireland's very lucky, it has a very strong civil society. I'm not sure that we have been as strong as we could have been, mm-hmm. or as vocal as we could have been, or as active as we could have been. And I do think there's an opportunity in the face of, I don't want to be overly critical, but in the face of a political impasse and the impotence of our politicians to make some really tough decisions, civil society can step in and exercise authority and exercise a kind of moral authority around these issues that I think politicians find it very hard to do.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, art, sport,
absolutely,
green spaces, opportunities to exercise, connections, all of that stuff, music, fundamental, that's where the healing happens. Yep. That works on a level that we can't even really understand, but it really, really works. Yep. And it helps with the regulation, it helps with the peace building, it helps with all of those things. But again, I mean, thinking about our education system, you know, schools want to do mental health. It's the thing that all schools should be doing. So they bring in a counsellor and they say we need more services and all of that. But yet our whole education system is setting up the majority of our young people to fail. Yep. We measure the failure. There's a proportion of all those GCSEs and A-levels, there's a proportion who will always fail, because you know, because that's the system that we operate in, and it's terrible and it's really harmful. Yeah. And then we have to rebuild our young people after that and get them, you know, trying to find their passion and what their strengths are and get them into jobs so that they can support the economy here. Like, it's just completely twisted to view mental health. And my job is really to get that message out. And your experience, Morgan, is probably... You're living it like every day as a young person.
I suppose sort of going back to what Peter was saying as well, it's not a mental health isn't a controversial issue. I'm sure there's not one politician who doesn't want to do something about it, but because it's so broad and there's so much sort of detail and technical sort of issues that we have to deal with, especially in Northern Ireland. With regards to mental health, there's an iffiness almost, because especially sort of with politicians, because of the sort of designation system that we have. So, for example, when you're talking about intergenerational trauma, Siobhan, if you went, oh, this is because of, you know, intergenerational trauma stems from people's sort of experiences or people's parents' experiences of what happened in the Troubles, and suddenly everyone goes quiet.
Yeah.
So it's almost like what you sort of the memory thing with intergenerational trauma, it's a vicious circle, like
it really is. And our politicians are looking for votes as well
are.
At the end of the day, so they have to keep you scared, so they have to emphasize the difference and where how they're going to protect their tribe.
But I think you're being generous in saying that that's a memory on the part of politicians. Politicians operate now still in the same divide that they had 20 years ago. They're still appealing to one half of the community. And in order for that to work, you have to maintain that half of the community as separate from the other half. If people started operating together, our current political system wouldn't work. So, you know, there is a vested interest on the part of our politicians to keep people divided. And I think that's something that doesn't get talked about often and is difficult.
And if this is, you know, if there is an issue in the kind of approach that's coming from the top down, what is the opportunity, I guess, for leadership to come up from the bottom? And how can that take place in a collaborative sense? And I'm thinking about this as an all-Ireland issue, not just Northern Ireland, not just the Republic of Ireland, but how can that kind of leadership come up from the bottom and support these kind of issues, I guess, in a holistic way that takes into consideration all the different groups of people? And, you know, I'm thinking even... beyond, you know, people who have these memories, people who are also coming into the country, into the island, and who are being affected by various different experiences from outside the island, people who are in the island who are being affected by experiences that they've had here, and I guess addressing those multiplicity of issues while kind of overcoming those divides that do exist in perhaps in the kind of political responses. Well, what are the opportunities for having that leadership from the bottom?
I
was just going to say, sort of through grassroots organisations such as sort of the union, such as, you know, in Northern Ireland, especially in the past 2 or 3 years or so, we've got a lot better at getting those, especially those youth organisations and those grassroots organisations. You're looking at Pure Mental, Crisis Cafe, Youth Forum, the Youth Assembly in the past year. We've got a lot better at starting these grassroots organisations and creating leaders out of those that will inevitably, some of them go on to hold seats in the Assembly, whether it be, you know, Northern Ireland Assembly, the Dáil, Westminster. So we are creating those leaders, and it's sort of coming from my end, we would collaborate with the sort of Our Alternative Down South, which is the Irish Secondary Students Union SU. So even creating opportunities from those collaborations and from those sort of joint, not like tasks, but joint experiences, if you will, and trying to connect sort of from an all-island approach, that works really well, I think, to create leaders from sort of our civil society to go on higher, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, you've mentioned there that kind of all-island approach, and that's something that certainly has come into the, I guess, at the very start of your organisation.
Yeah.
I know, Siobhan, you're also looking at opportunities now for work in mental health that takes on that kind of all-island perspective.
Well, we have strategy in the north here and a strategy in the Republic of Ireland to improve mental health services. And you know, they're carbon copies of one another. Arguably, the one in the Republic goes a bit further because it's cross-departmental. But, you know, hopefully our programme for government we'll cover that. But there's services that we lack up here. And, you know, there's very specialist services that are very expensive, that we could be sharing those services, you know, and so that people can receive help for their mental health or treatments for their for mental illness that's, you know, local to them, because it's important that these things are provided in communities. So if you live in a border area, why would you not be, you know, have access to a service on the other side of the border that would meet your needs? I mean, that makes perfect sense, and it brings savings as well. So that stuff's fundamental. And I also think the opportunities for sport, arts, culture, music, all of that stuff can be shared across the island, and everybody benefits. Mm-hmm. So just opening things out and making things available, whether it's treatments or whether it's those broad universal things, mm-hmm. that actually will create that shift, mm-hmm. To prevent mental illness and to help us all sort of flourish together, I guess. So, mm-hmm.
And I guess coming on from that to Peter, I guess you've worked so much in civil society and in community and voluntary sector. I'm wondering, what is the role of community and voluntary sector in addressing this on an all-island basis?
So I think it has a hugely important role. And I'm very, so let me just say something. I'm very conscious of the fact that in talking about an all-island approach, mm-hmm. there is a section of the Northern Ireland population that would see even that language as profoundly threatening. Mm-hmm. So we can't be naive about that. That is just a fact. Mm-hmm. So having said that, that factors in also to the political situation here. The community and voluntary sector is probably largely cross-community. There are certain components of it that would be single identity, but mostly the voluntary community sector here is cross-community. It reflects both sides or all sides of communities. And that's its great strength. And the challenge here is how you start to get collaboration and communication, because while we have a particular story to tell around mental health in Northern Ireland to do with trauma and to do with the Troubles, there is another story to be told in the Republic of Ireland about the last 20 years of huge transition and change, social change in the Republic of Ireland that has in lots of ways impacted people's mental health there. So if we reduce this down just to what it means to be a human being, to live in an environment that is challenging and changing, and find ways to get people talking about that, where people who have grown up in this or understand this setting are able to share their experience with people who've grown up in different settings. What we do naturally as human beings is we're always looking for points of connection. Mm-hmm. That's when you meet somebody new in Northern Ireland or in Ireland, you want to know, you know, am I related to you? Did we go to school together? Does my sister know your brother? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, people want to make connections. So if we can find commonality, then that's where we are able to build relationship. And I think the community and voluntary sector is a safe place to have some of those conversations. And with support and with a bit of outreach, that is eminently possible. And I think would be incredibly constructive.
Mm-hmm. And there are people, though, who live in the Republic of Ireland who have all that trauma exposure, yeah. and feel very isolated and can't talk about it and don't have the vehicles that we have in Northern Ireland to understand that, you know. So that's having an impact there. And I think that's a conversation that needs to be had south of the border as well. What sort of services are there? Whose responsibility is it to provide those very focused treatments that are needed, you know, to improve their lives? So I think there's that issue as well. And we're still sending people over to England, Scotland and Wales for treatment for mental health problems, for people with very complex mental health needs, you know, and we should be sharing this stuff across the island. We don't have a mother and baby unit anywhere on the island. If we could get one somewhere, it would be a start, you know, so that we can keep mothers with their wee babies. And that helps everybody. So there's a lot of stuff we need to be doing straight away. And we've already done it for cardiac services, incidentally. Yeah. So there's a lot of this is actually already happening. And it's about making sure that people get accessible treatment in a timely way that makes sense. So I think we need to be very pragmatic as well about this conversation, you know, and do stuff that will benefit both parties, because we can't afford to be wasting money and duplicating things as well, you know, in the current climate too.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you've, especially Peter, you've just mentioned now, just before Siobhan, about making those connections, and you've sort of built on that, Siobhan. And I'm just wondering, kind of coming right now to the new generation of people who are working in this area, I'm wondering what kind of connections you've made, Morgan, now in the past year or two, mm-hmm. And how those have benefited the work that your organisation has been doing.
Oh, it's benefited hugely. I mean, Siobhan, I remember, she was at the launch of our mental health report, and I don't think we could have legitimately launched that report without sort of yourself there, or without the MLAs that were there. It's a very sort of, with youth engagement, it very much relies on adults and older people to sort of take us under their wing almost, and for that we rely on them to support us and sort of publicise us a bit more, so that we get the attention that we need to bring the issues to the forefront. So the connections, you know, have been so helpful and so necessary as well, sadly, but you know, that's just how it is.
And people like Morgan give us the hope. Absolutely. As well. It's just so exciting, you know, you get so proud when you see somebody mm-hmm. stepping up there and you know, grasping the metal and just going forward, like to create the sort of change. So that gives us confidence that, you know, our children and grandchildren maybe even will have a much better future and won't have the same sort of struggles as our generation had.
Mm-hmm. But we need to step up as well.
We do.
We're not off the hook. Our generation has a lot to make up for. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a terrible burden to put it on young people to kind of fix this stuff that we messed up. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't mean that as a criticism, what you're saying. I just mean that we have an opportunity. I think time mm-hmm. has gone on. You've got people like Siobhan in roles like you're in. And I do think it is fantastic that Northern Ireland has appointed a mental health champion and that Siobhan is doing it, because it in a very physical and visible way prioritises something. Mm-hmm. And I think that is an opportunity that we have now as a society to say, yes, we take this seriously. Mm-hmm. As a society, we take it seriously. Politically, we take it seriously. And we're now going to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And that's not just young people or old people. It's us all together saying we have something we need to fix here. Mm-hmm. And we're going to work on it together. And the more civic society gets engaged with that, and the more support we can get across the island, then, you know, we get the benefit of that, but also we're able to share our learning. And the one thing I have learnt from bits and pieces of work that I've done outside of Northern Ireland is we have a huge amount to contribute to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. We really do. We've got something that is very valuable to be understood in other settings as well.
Mm-hmm. I think it seems overall that there have been a lot of lessons learned, and that they seem to be contributing to moving things really in a very progressive direction. And I mean, that's something that we've seen as we've looked through, you know, the origins of this kind of work coming through to, you know, the appointment of for example, your position now, Siobhan, and the work that you're doing, Morgan. So I think it's been really kind of hopeful to see that moving in the right direction, those kind of connections being made, and these kind of holistic approaches to be taken, and the people are recognising this issue more and more and responding to it in ways that are more appropriate for the underlying issues that are creating issues in mental health. So thank you very much to all of you for joining us today. And thank you for all your very valuable contributions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Across Divides. Learn more about today's topic and find opportunities to get involved at icommunityhub.org. iCommunity is a joint initiative of The Wheel and NICFA and is supported by the Northern Ireland Department for Communities, the Department of Foreign Affairs Reconciliation Fund, and the Shared Island Unit in the Department of the Taoiseach.